Great to have you with us this morning. We are about to talk to a man who's a fantastic VFL football figure. Started his career over in Western Australia as a player and a premiership coach with Claremont, then coached the Fremantle Footy Club for 4 years, and now continues to do outstanding work with young Indigenous people with the Clontarf Foundation. His name's Jared Neesham. He's good enough to join us. Welcome, Jared. Great to talk to you.
G'day, Gary. How you going? I've played nine games for Sydney Swans, mate. I wouldn't put it much of a VFL career like you fellas.
They were great games. Great games, Jared, that you played.
It was a great year.
You're still doing your work with the Clontarf Academy, which I think is just sensational. Can you tell us a little bit about that before we get into this amazing story that Tim's alerted us to?
When I finished coaching, you had to go and find something to do. I wasn't really going to move into state, so I went back to teaching and then just stumbled on the fact that if you put something at school the kids like, they might go. So it was about that simple, and I just was teaching with some young Aboriginal fellows then, and so I cornered the idea along with Ross Kelly, the chairman of Fremantle, who'd left at the same time as myself, to start a little foundation getting these boys to go to the school, because the school attendance was dreadful. And that was back in 1999, or late 99, we started it. And with myself, and then I employed a young fella, and fast forward 20 years, we've gone from 25 boys this year, and two staff. Well, this year we're about 460 full-time staff somewhere in Australia, and over 9,000 boys, young men being fully mentored through their high school, from as places as far apart as Warrnambool, Cairns, Gove and Esperance, Broome, Geraldton and Kempsey and everywhere you can imagine. So, Lakes Entrance, Bairnsdale. So, yeah, that's been quite an amazing journey. In fact, the most amazing journey of all of them, really. So it's been a wonderful thing to do and to stumble onto and to find something that can help kids who otherwise found school really difficult. Made going through school a lot easier and a lot more attractive. So that's the nutshell of that. Clontarf, that's my day job and keeps me very occupied.
And look, another quick one just on that. So when you see the great stories of recent times, Sydney Stack and Marlon Pickett and others that have, particularly as Marlon had some challenges, but have been able to work their way back. I mean, how aspirational are those stories and how important are they for our young Indigenous lads?
I think, the amount of young Aboriginal men over the years, in particular the last 20 years, who've come into the AFL and played, have really, they stimulate an opportunity or a dream in a young boy's life, and they see them up on the big stage playing and being successful, Cyril Rioli, whoever it is. And like any normal kid, they want to be like them. Well, you can't be an elite sportsman unless you go to school. That's the first step in the way. And yeah, we've got quite a lot of our young fellas who are in the AFL who've come through our program. And obviously in New South Wales and Queensland, we use rugby league as the attractor to get them to go to school. So yeah, so it's some of the boys who've come through in those other states who are playing NRL now. So, but we don't care about where they play. With the majority of the boys, like the majority of kids at Assumption or Halebury or wherever, just go to school, don't end up a sportsman and get a job. We'll go to university, and that's really where the majority of our boys end up, getting a job.
Talking to Jared Neesham, the former AFL coach of the Dockers. Now, Jared, the reason why we actually got you on this morning is that I was with Neil Danaher on Friday for an MND thing that we were doing, and we started talking about the doco, the Michael Jordan doco, The Last Dance. And he told me that the day that Steve Kerr and Michael Jordan got into a stoush at training, you and he were there in the stands recording it and watching it unfold. Is that correct?
I actually can't answer that, Tim. I'd like to answer it, but there was an incident that happened. We were in this tiny little, like a little opera setting up way above the training basketball court, So there was a room for about three. There was Rowdy and myself sitting up there watching it and filming, yeah, and I don't know where that ever went. But there was an incident, and then Michael Jordan came over and looked at us two and said, "You two Aussies." And we looked at him and he said, "You didn't see anything." So I'm by the fact that 22 years ago, said to me, "We didn't see anything." And I went, "Yeah, no problem."
So if you had seen something, what would you have seen?
Well, maybe someone getting, you know, belted. But if I had seen it, that's what I would have seen. But I was looking the other way. I think whatever happened, I don't know where Rowdy was looking. But, yeah, it was pretty... As it's turned out, it was pretty extraordinary that, you know, we were given the opportunity to go and spend 4 or 5 days there, thanks to Luke Longley. First of all, thanks to Ross Kelly, our chairman of Fremantle, and David Hatt, our CEO, to give Neil and I the chance. The funny or sad part was the third coach, when he had three coaches those days, was Mark Riley, who you know really well. Yeah. And Bomber didn't get the gig, so... You could have been talking to him instead of me today. But, yeah, we went and we spent 4 days and we got fabulous access. You know, we were in training all day, every day with them, watching and allowed to, you know, talk to people. Yeah, it was incredible.
So, Jared, did you watch The Last Dance? Did you catch up with the documentary?
Well, it's funny you ask that. My youngest son, who's a really good water polo player, plays at the National League, Clancy, he said, "Oh, Dad, you got to watch this Last Dance." And so I told him, "Mate," I said, I've been in that space and I found the guys pretty arrogant and they weren't sort of my cup of tea. He said, no, you got to watch it." I said, "Mate, I'm not going to watch it." Anyway, the bottom line was he harassed me enough. So I eventually watched it and it gave me a proper understanding of where I was at. Where Neil and I were at, you know, we were watching people who were really going aggressively at training, you know, really demanding a high standard. And because we were only sitting in there for a few hours of each day, for a few days, and you got to speak to Larry Krause and spent time with him and spent time with quite a bit of time with Phil Jackson, I didn't really get an understanding of the whole picture. And I don't think anyone has until this series has come out, and it showed... Really an amazing story to see, you know, him being so determined to win and then getting belted up by Detroit and then deciding to do weights and to become big and aggressive and then for the team to go and get Rodman so they could really compete aggressively and still maintain his great talent even though he was a marked man. I think it's one of the truly amazing stories, and it happened to have been there for a few days. It was you know, sort of made it good fun now.
Well, when you saw Steve Kirk, because I think it was in probably episode 7 or 8.
It was Steve Kirk. I didn't see get hit.
It was.
Yes, exactly. No,
it wasn't. Yeah, yeah, of course it wasn't. But if you had seen Steve Kirk get hit, when you listened to that story, did you sit there and what were your emotions when you saw that when replayed?
Oh, I know, we've seen plenty of guys get hit at training and footy, so it's sort of not much basketball. You don't expect
Not by the greatest athlete on the planet, though.
Well, if you're going to get hit by someone, you must get hit by him. I mean, you know, there's something to tell your grandkids, you know. So they were intensive training. Rodman was an extremely intensive trainer, and Jackson was telling us that he really had to concentrate on getting him out of this place. Their training venue was in Deerfield. And he said he would just train himself 12, 15 hours a day if I let him. So he was interesting to observe. And then the way Jackson managed them was fabulous. Like, he was a really lovely, quiet gentleman. You know, I always found it interesting when we used to meet with him that he had a lot of Red Indian paraphernalia in his office and stuff, and sort of we didn't chat about it, but it was obvious that there was some connection there for when you're sitting in his office to see it all around there. But he was a really, really smart coach. Of course, he don't be as successful as he was, but we learned some really interesting stuff off him because from a point of view of sport, he was, you know, they had really basically moved from a zone to where you had to play man on man in the forward half, and there were time restrictions. So he had to deal with some, like, Luke wasn't as mobile as you'd like, but he was 6'3", so he was pretty handy to have in the team. Mm. So he had to deal with issues of not having a very fast team sometimes on the field, and talking to him about the technicality of it was really interesting. So there was that sort of stuff is what we were looking for when we spoke to Jerry Krause, was, you know, how did you recruit this guy, you know, Jordan? Because it's okay for everyone to say Jordan was a legend. Well, he's a legend now. He's been the most incredible sportsman probably of all time. But, you know, he said, oh, I really like the fact that he was 6'6", but he had a reach of about 7 foot. So he had these really long arms, and he's watching at college, and he had the ability to be able to, well, an extra 6 inches makes a massive difference. So we had lots of interesting talks and times with them. We went to a game, but the game was pretty nondescript because it wasn't a home and away season. I reckon it was a pre-season game, and people were more intent on going and wandering to the bar, etc. So it wasn't the sort of games you saw on the Last Dance series where the intensity of the finals were incredible, and they were great to see. So we sort of got them in a pre-season from memory, and we then went out socially with them, which was interesting in itself because they're high profile. They just had to be able to go somewhere where no one else was, basically. Yeah. And so we went out, Rowdy, myself and Luke and those other fellas went out and just sat around. It was as boring as batshit. So, you know. So I wouldn't get too enamoured by, I mean, I think Jordan said it, that, you know, like, you have to give up a hell of a lot to be Michael Jordan, and that's part of the issue with giving up your anonymity. Well, he's given it up to some extreme level, you know. Obviously, he gets paid for it, but there's a cost to it as well.
Jared, we talked about you earlier this morning about the game plan, you know, when you were coaching Fremantle many, many years ago. And if you were to step back into AFL football today, no one would bat an eyelid at the way that you had your team playing, whereas back then it was so revolutionary, the style of football that you were implementing. When you reflect back on those days, what is it that you think about what you were introducing then and how it would stand up today in the way the game's being played?
That's a hard one to answer, Tim. Look, we were endeavouring to take possession in the back line, and I think it's a classic situation that, you know, it's obvious if you can take possession. If you're Steve Silvani, you mark it. I mean, I think nearly the greatest piece of play I've ever seen in football was that young McGovern. When he took that mark in the last dying minutes of the grand final, he'd already worked out that he had to play on even if he marked it. And he'd already worked out who he was kicking it to because the guy had limited space. And he'd nailed the next kick, which allowed the whole passage of play to get to the other end. And, you know, if he went up and spoilt it, you know, every chance that, you know, his opponent's going to get the ball over the back. And I think taking possession in the back and moving the ball quickly away from the crowd, that sort of stuff's, you know, pretty standard now, except the trouble is that the transition, the players are so quick at running across the field and moving into a defensive area that it's actually pretty ugly. You know, it's moved past when we were at the Bulls, they had actually moved away from the zones and because the game had become ugly, basketball. And really, we've moved into the zones, you know, where everyone goes back in the back half. You might as well go to the bar when that happens because it's just too crowded and you don't see the... Which is sad. I mean, hopefully they'll work out how to get it back into a you know, a game that more resembles the 80s, I think. You know, the great film clips that you see where it's a lot of one-on-one contests with fabulous full forwards and, you know, good forwards and good midfielders. But having said that, I mean, the skill level is fabulous that the blokes have got these days. But, you know, when it does get crowded, you know, leave me out of it. But, I mean, I coached 22 years ago and I haven't coached since. The sport's moved a long way somewhere and I wouldn't know where that is. You know, Clarks and all these guys are wonderful coaches and what they did do is they got out and about and started, you know, trying to learn what was happening in other sports in around the globe, I think the one thing I was lucky, people think it was water polo, was just that you had international. I was lucky to play water polo, which had a lot of international information, you know, counter-attack and zones and pressing and all sorts of stuff. And obviously you could use them in footy, even though it sounds crazy, but you can, because water polo is only 6-on-6, and normally footy is only 6-on-6. You don't have more people around the pill than that. So it was numerical. It wasn't anything that outside of that. So anyway, it was good fun, and we played pretty exciting football. When it worked, it was good, and when it didn't, it cost me my job, so it didn't work more than not. Having said that, I'm glad I did it. I'm really rapt I got to coach Fremantle and be the first coach, but I'm, you know, like I couldn't imagine life without doing what I've been doing for the last 20 years. It's been an incredible transition out of AFL into something that's really, really exciting every day and really purposeful.
Well, your legacy is going to be profound in that area, no question about that, but there's a legacy in footy as well, and there's a legacy in what you didn't see in that day in Chicago at training as well. So we appreciate you for jumping on and not confirming that, but that is an incredible story, and we love that.
That's no problem. The big man might want to belt me, and I'm not keen on that.
He won't find you. Don't worry. We won't talk about it.
He's coughing up. Okay.
Good on you. Great to talk to you. Jared Neesham, a great character in footy. What a great story. We'll be back and have a chat with it after the news headlines.